Welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Gillian Tobias. This week's film review is a rather winding road that features everything from Egyptian gods to possessed children via some Scottish folk singers and a French sex party. Plenty to fit in, so who better to make sense of it all than film critic and good friend of Monocle, Karen Krzanovich. That's all to come right here on the Monocle Arts Review. Our first film today takes us to Egypt, where a battle for the throne between two gods, Set and Horus, is underway. Gods of Egypt is the latest film by Alex Proyas, the director behind iRobot and The Crow. It's an ambitious mega-budget film at $140 million. Let's hear what this sounds like. Here's a clip from the movie trailer.
You know what's waiting. Set has an army behind him. Gods, beasts, demons.
You will bring them reckoning!
Bow before me or die. I won't make that mistake.
A lively sampler there from the movie Gods of Egypt. Now, Karen, Variety described this as, and I quote, a dreadful movie, a chintzy CG-encrusted eyesore that oozes stupidity and self-indulgence from every pore. What did you think?
That's about right. But I love a movie like this. I do. And I love the fact that it had hopes of greatness. You know, it's almost like John Carter, which of course is a better film, I have to say. But Gods of Egypt is one of those huge lumpen something went wrong kind of things that I actually like. Studios hate that ruin careers, ruin directors' careers, and make studio bosses have to resign. Now this is the kind of film it is. $140 million in this environment, in this business environment, is not small beans. And we've got Matt Zadzama and Burke Sharpless, who wrote respectable Power Rangers, Dracula Untold, Last Witch Hunter. This script has been tampered with is the only thing I can say. There's so many anachronisms in it. You know, I don't know about you, but they're trying to capture this kind of old-fashioned Ray Harryhausen kind of feel, you know, where the gods are English and they speak, you know, nicely. And these are full of anachronisms. Like, you expect them to go snap and dude any minute.
Is it possible to summarize the plot?
Yes. It's based on a myth of the Egyptian gods fighting. And what happens is Osiris, Brian Brown, is about ready to hand over to his son, Horus, the kingdom. And in comes Jared Butler, who is Set, and says, no, I'm going to do it. I'm going to take it away, and I'm going to be really mean while I do it.
And one of the mean things he does at the beginning?
He's a terrible person. He tears out Horus's eyes, both of them, even though in myth he only tears out one. So there, even then they can't even stick to fact.
The cinematography and the special effects look like they are expensive.
Yes.
They talk about this sort of very sort of golden hue throughout the film and a bit... Almost like a stage set, almost sort of theatrical.
Very much so, very much so. Another thing that I really liked, every film like this has something great in it, and the gods bleed gold.
Oh my
goodness.
Which is,
you know, it's amazing. It's, you know, I've seen it in some other films, but it really actually works here. And in fact, 200 of the same cast and crew members worked on Mad Max Fury Road. PJ was the same first AD, Tim Wong for stunts and other people. So this is not a matter of not having skilled people working on the film. It's a matter of having a script problem. That's the problem.
If you are tempted, Gods of Egypt premiered in North America earlier this year and has just reached cinemas in the UK and Ireland. And it's going to hit Spain next week.
It actually did very, very well in Russia, Thailand, Malaysia, Singapore and the Philippines.
There you go.
There you go.
Now, from Egyptian gods to English ghouls, our next film is The Conjuring 2. This movie is based on a true story of the Enfield haunting. Set in 1977, it follows paranormal investigators Lorraine and Ed Warren, who travel to a North London council estate to help a single mother raising four children in a cursed house, the youngest of which appears to be possessed. Karen, sounds like the making of quite a classic horror movie.
Yes, I loved The Conjuring. The first one was so beautiful. And it's one of these films that I'm not a horror person, But Julie Berghoff did the production design on this, and very rarely do I notice production design on a horror film. But The Conjuring looks amazing, and she's also working on The Conjuring 2, and it looks astonishing. In fact, there's one character in The Conjuring 2, and I'm not going to spoil it, that is going to go on and have its own film, its own character spinoff, so that's quite good. The real draw of this is Lorraine and Ed Warren, Vera Farmiga and Patrick Wilson, who play amazingly together. They've got a wonderful chemistry, and you can believe them. They do, in fact, play a real-life couple. I believe one of them has passed on now. Ooh, sorry. Sorry to throw that in. But this time they do encounter the famous Enfield poltergeist of 1977. James Wan said he always wanted to make a big budget horror movie, and he doesn't stick to fact here, but who cares, because I was scared to tears.
Let's hear what that fright sounds like.
This is my home. Get out now.
No, this is not your house. Now, what's your name?
My name is Bill Wilkins, and I'm 72 years old.
What do you make of that voice?
Sounds confused. Is he senile?
The voice on this tape is coming from an 11-year-old girl.
And that was a clip from the new movie, The Conjuring 2. We talked about it being set in 1977, a very period piece. Now, what I find interesting talking to you, not just as a critic, but you worked on this film in the production department. What was the research process?
I did.
Like?
I worked in the art department as the I did the British-based research of factual and image. It was very, very difficult, actually, to find really good images of 1977, particularly Enfield. And although Enfield Museum has some really good stuff up there, but there weren't a lot of photographs taken, particularly of trains and things like that. And also, we had to look for a Christmas tree, and all the Christmas trees were very sad in 1977.
But research is so key and can make or break the final impact of a film, because it has to, no matter how fantastical the story, but the power is going to lie in some sense of this could be real.
Of
and
course.
And that comes from a touch of authenticity.
Well, you have to get the detail, but sometimes you can't actually be completely correct, because sometimes the correct thing looks wrong. And that's where Julie Berghoff, who is the production designer, steps in and makes this a seamless movie. It's not because I worked on it, but I really would like it even if I hadn't worked on it.
Tell us about the young actress, Madison Wolf, a 13-year-old actress who plays the possessed girl.
She's amazing, actually. She's absolutely astonishing. And it's you know, we're all focused on the American. Patrick Wilson puts in a terrific performance as well. There's a very, very long take that he does that is quite famous for now. But the children are astonishing. A lot rests on them. And also Peggy Hodgson, I should have written down the actress's name. She is brilliant as well. And the whole cast really makes you believe what's going on, even though you know it couldn't possibly happen.
Hairs on the back of my neck rising already. The Conjuring 2 is out now in the UK and the US of A. Our final film up for review today is a new documentary called Where You're Meant to Be, which just premiered at this year's Sheffield Documentary Festival. This started off following Scottish cult pop raconteur and Arab Strap frontman Aidan Moffat as he toured Scotland in 2014, performing reinterpretations of old folk songs. But then the plot was diverted after Moffat met folk royalty, the late Sheila Stewart. Now, Karen, for starters, just tell us a little bit about the music of Sheila Stewart.
Sheila Stewart is a traveler. She's also sung for the Pope. She's sung for the White House. She's an MBE, or was. She just passed away in 2014. She was keeping together the Scottish tradition of the traditional folk songs. Now, Scotland has a tradition where everybody has to perform. Everybody has a turn, as they say. And I don't know any other culture that does that. I'm sure there are. But everyone can sing, and she wants to keep the value of these songs about plowing, songs about the stars and romance. And meanwhile, you've got Moffat throwing, you know, cell phones and swear words into changing all the lyrics and keeping the actual song. But the people are listening to him
giving
changing.
It a bit of a contemporary spin.
Very much a contemporary spin. But he's singing to this audience, and they're all kind of, you know, dirty lyrics, okay. And it's surprisingly bawdy and earthy, and I like that, but I'm still a bit shocked. And then they're all singing along to the nice, clean chorus in the middle. But it's very funny, and I think what's interesting is that we may think that if this was Portuguese or Spanish or Malawi, it would be fascinating. fascinating? Well, it's Scottish and it's really fascinating.
Let's have a listen.
Did you know you didn't have long? Were you scared we'd forget you? Or did you just want the song sung right? You've been on my mind a lot, Sheila. But before we met, I was just hoping for a good laugh. When I resolved to leave the
blue, a little sampler there from Where You're Meant to Be. What touched you about this film?
It's astonishingly moving, actually. I mean, I've lived up in Scotland, and I'm fascinated by the culture anyway. But the songs, the way the people come together, there are some people that have lost their loved ones. They talk about how the songs affected them, and it is quite moving. It's the passing of an age, and that's always quite upsetting, I suppose, seeing something disappear into the past.
And how does I suppose Scotland is one of the leading players in this film as a backdrop, but also as a character. What do we take away about Scotland and the Scots?
Well, that a lot of it's very rural, but the people come together and they're very warm and they're incredibly smart and they're very funny and they're very bawdy. And they sure can sing, though. Every single one of them can sing really well. And that's when you hear some of these ordinary people singing, you will weep.
For people who don't know, who is Moffat and what's he known for?
He's one of Scotland's sort of premier seminal new musicians. He was part of a band called Arab Strap, which was quite important. And he's very active in the arts there and very passionate about keeping his own culture thriving.
But quite an irreverent sense of humor, would you say?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, he has written, you know me, I'm pretty, I can take
irreverent
salty
yourself.
Language. I can take salty language. But some of the lyrics that he sings, I just think, ooh, glad my mother isn't here.
Well, Where You Were Meant to Be premiered at this year's Sheffield Documentary Festival and is showing in UK cinemas as of today. Now, before we go, we're going to have a quick preview of tonight's edition of The Cinema Show. Eva Husson is the director of a new French film called Bang Gang, A Modern Love Story, which follows a group of teenagers in a small town who liven up one bored summer by throwing sex parties and documenting them with their smartphones. It's an exploration of teenage naivety, and in this preview, Husson speaks to Ben Ryland about nudity in film.
I'm going to take you back to 1999. I basically came across that piece of news about a high school in Rockdale County in Georgia in the States. And these kids had syphilis, basically, and the hospital discovered while they were testing them that they had parties, wild parties, and that, you know, they were organizing stuff that suddenly became out of control, and it became this big thing. And I got fascinated by the whole thing. I was like, how did that happen? You know, I come from a middle-class background myself, small town, and we didn't go that far. We were bored as well. And I just, you know, started to get curious about the whole thing.
Let's talk about the nakedness that's in the movie. There's a lot of bare flesh running throughout the film.
It starts with
a lot of bare butts, and then it ends with a lot of bare butts and everything in between as well. So tell me about your attitudes towards that and how you projected that onto this cast of characters, all of them teenagers, depicting teenagers, of course. In one way, it's sort of, you know, because you've got the parents in the film as well, and a lot of their attitudes shame their children for engaging in such behaviour. Some of them don't necessarily shame their kids. They try to educate them in a way. But then also the film takes a view that nakedness is a form of liberation and it makes you feel free. You don't come away from the film really feeling as though you've been told to treat nudity in any particular sort of way. Was that intentional on your part?
I think it comes from my background and the idea that nakedness is the most natural thing on earth. I mean, you come to the world naked and it entails a lot much more than sexuality. And one of the things, one of the journeys I was very interested in taking was to show, or to, at least to explore the idea that once you've been naked 100 times, it all goes back to the basic things, which are, do I love you? Do you love me? it's not naked, being naked, that's so special, you know, about being together. A lot of people do it. It's just the connections that people have amongst themselves.
That was Eva Husson, director of Bang Gang. Don't forget to tune in to tonight's cinema show to hear the rest of the interview. That's at 2000 hours London time. That brings us to the end of today's show. My thanks to my guest, Karen Krizanovich. You've been listening to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Gillian Tobias. This show was produced by Holly Fisher. Join us again at the same time on Monday when we'll be rounding up this year's edition of Art Basel with Art Newspaper's Jane Morris. But for now, goodbye from me, and thanks for listening.